From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. New Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Gregory Thornton began his tenure July 1st. Schools will be back in session in less than 2 weeks, and Thornton joins us this morning in studio to talk about his priorities for city schools. Then, if you reduce food to its essentials, carbohydrates, proteins, vitamins, other nutrients, you'd get something that looks like Soylent. It's a nutritionally complete shake that aims to replace normal food. Tom Hall gets the scoop on Soylent from nutritionist Monica Reinickel, and our senior producer Matt Purdy reports back on his experiment trying to live off the stuff for a week.
I remember I broke down and I had a carrot after work on Wednesday, and I crunched into this carrot, and it was a revelatory carrot.
First the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We hope you're enjoying your summer because it will soon be over. One unequivocal sign, schools start back soon. Baltimore City Schools will welcome back its more than 80,000 students in less than 2 weeks on August 25th. And when the pupils arrive, there will be a new leader at North Avenue to greet them. New Baltimore City Schools CEO Gregory Thornton began work on July 1st, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Well, great, and it's great to be in Baltimore.
You were superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools for 4 years. Why did you decide to come to Baltimore?
It was a very hard decision. Milwaukee was a wonderful place that we had an opportunity to do some really great things for children and families. Baltimore created an opportunity to come home. In many ways, Maryland is one of my homes. I was actually partially reared on the shores of Maryland, and certainly the proximity to Philadelphia, where we still have family, was an opportunity, I think, to really position myself, certainly to do some great work, to continue the work that's been going on in Baltimore, as well as get a little closer to family.
You have been on the job 6 weeks.
Yes, ma'am.
What have been the biggest challenges so far?
Oh, getting to know the system. Certainly there's been a lot of great work that's happened. How do you continue to work? Beginning to take deep dives as to what's working, what's not working, what's been the impact of certainly the reforms that are in place, and really getting to know people. It's a community that's very interested and very focused around its children. So I've had a great opportunity to begin to build some relationships, certainly in our community, which I think are vital and create the sustainability that our children need to certainly be successful in school.
You brought your chief of staff with you from Milwaukee. Naomi,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm blanking on
Gurunik, yes,
yes,
I did.
But I pick up some concern about from some people that your whole cabinet is new, sort of all your deputies are new, and there's a lot of learning curve people feel. How do you deal with that?
We're about 50-50, and certainly there was a lot of institutional knowledge that certainly existed. So as we move forward, what we attempt to do is to get the right person in the right seat at the right time. So certainly there are new members of my cabinet that are new to Baltimore. We have a chief, human capital officer that we brought in from Baltimore County. We have a chief academic officer, which we brought in from the Boston area. And we have a chief financial officer, in which we brought in via Seattle, then Boston, and has done some great work around the country with Council Great City Schools. But then we thought we had a really great, talented chief informational officer. Certainly we retained that individual. We retained our chief operations officer. We retained a strong cabinet, tier two, what I would call executive directors at that level. So it's a blend. It's a family coming together to do really great things for the community.
I think there's a real hunger to know what your vision is. What changes should parents expect from you,
well,
CEO?
I would hope my vision is the same as theirs, is that we can position their young people to really do great things. You know, as a parent, I'm a grandparent, and I will tell you, I go to bed every night concerned, hoping that my little granddaughter and my children's hopes and dreams certainly come true, and my vision is no different than that. I think what they can expect is a relentless focus around student achievement. I think they can expect a relentless focus around rigor and a relentless focus around the fact that we're going to do everything possible to ensure that our youngsters that we are entrusted will have the opportunities that we would want all children to have in America.
You mentioned student achievement. As you know, there's a debate nationally as well as in Maryland about evaluating teachers. What are your views about what role test scores should play in evaluating teachers?
Well, accountability is certainly not a major driver, but I think accountability gives us an opportunity to identify challenges in which we have. Test scores certainly provide a direction, focus where we need to spend our energy. I'm a strong proponent that the real work begins in the classroom, and educator effectiveness is certainly the flavor of the month for us. That's where we're going. We need to be certain that the experiences that kids have, young people have with their teachers, is premier and it optimizes the learning environment. And certainly test scores certainly point to the fact whether we're making the grade. But I would go on and say that it's more than test scores. It's about the quality of life. It's around the experience and the relationships that I think develop between teachers and students. That's where the magic actually happens. But it's a blended approach to looking at holistic change for young people in classrooms around not just Baltimore, but around the world.
When you were named Baltimore City School CEO in February, we spoke with Erin Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Here's part of what she told us.
One of his most appreciated improvements was trying to standardize the curriculum from school to school. Before Thornton took over, Milwaukee Public Schools was a more decentralized district.
I think that caught the ears of a lot of people here. She told us that you cut back on some of the autonomy that had existed in each school before you came to Milwaukee. And that sounds like the opposite course of what the Baltimore City Schools have been in. Your predecessor, Andres Alonso, gave a lot of authority to principals to make decisions about school budgets, curriculum, staff, et cetera. Will schools' autonomy change?
Potentially. I don't believe there's one way. I think each environment is different, and you have to assess where that particular organization is. I'm probably somewhere in the middle. It's a blended model. I believe all schools are not created equal. I believe all principals are not created equal. I believe all communities are not created equal. So what we have to do is create supports that meet the needs of individual schools, principals, as well as children. So what you will probably see from us is really a big conversation moving forward around what I would call earned autonomy. I believe autonomy is not something that you give. I think it's something that you earn, and you do that by demonstrating great results for children. So what I would imagine, if I had a crystal ball, that you would look into it this time next year and you would see some schools that potentially will continue to have those types of authorities and that type of responsibility and that level of accountability. But there will be some schools that we will actually probably pull it in a little bit and attempt to really standardize opportunities for children. I have to position young people, no matter where they sit in the city, that they're going to have a quality educational experience. You know, as I go from school to school, there's a tremendous amount of variance that I see. With respect to opportunities, there's an issue with respect to equity. And as we move forward, I believe one way of doing it is through leadership. I believe leadership is one of the transformational agents for the future of public education. So we work very hard to try to get quality leaders, but I would suggest that you would see a blended model of certainly some things that folks will have a lot of autonomy with, and there are things that I think we could better do centrally. And then there will be a group of folks that have demonstrated that they can make magic happen in classrooms and make magic happen in schools and magic happen in communities. They will get that autonomy.
So tell me more about what the parameters will be that you'll be looking at to decide which schools you're going to rein in and which schools will continue.
We're early in the thinking right now, as you mentioned, we're only 6 weeks in, and you know, I'm still finding my way from school to school, and on most days I still get lost. But we're looking at both a quantitative perspective, looking at certainly, as you talked about, the accountability, looking at certainly hard data as to whether kids are making the performance targets that we want.
And then so test scores would be part of what you'd look at?
They would be one of the things.
But
everything's multiple indicators. The other is a qualitative look and the experience that young people experience in classrooms with respect to great instructional designs and at the schoolhouse, at the classroom level, the whole qualitative side with respect to parent involvement, you know, community support and things of that nature. So what you attempt to do is to create some way in which you can merge the two to get a holistic view as to how school's doing, how fast is the school going, are they making the progress that as parents, as administrators, as the city would want to actually see happen. So with that, we would probably identify a group of schools that have done so. And I think they would create create what I would call an autonomy zone. Autonomy zone for those folks to have space in which they can certainly do some of the creative work. As a principal, I'm a former principal, and I know the frustration sometimes in a franchise type of school with a franchise agenda. And there were many times I just wanted to do great things. And really
franchise felt, agenda is
meaning
is
that
this
every
dispersed
everything meaning this very very centralized agenda.
Oh,
agenda,
very centralized.
Franchise. In a franchise, everybody does things the
okay.
same. And I always felt that, you know, I had great ideas and there were great opportunities I wanted to provide for my community and was unable to do so. And I believe there are principals who wake up every morning with the agenda on their mind is how can they make school exciting. And when you're totally franchised, when you're totally centralized, you miss that opportunity. So we want to certainly reward the folks who've done that and who have demonstrated that through the autonomy that's actually been given to all the schools in Baltimore. So we believe, as we move forward, you'll begin to see a bifurcation of certainly some folks that have a more restrictive environment and more centralized environment versus those who have a greater degree of autonomy.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with the new Baltimore City Public School CEO, Gregory Thornton. We're talking about his priorities for Baltimore school systems. Baltimore City is the only large district in Maryland that funds full-day pre-K. Is this an investment you plan to continue?
It's probably the best investment we can make. And what I know is a good start certainly creates the conditions for a great finish. And unfortunately, many of our young people for whatever reasons and for a number of reasons, don't have the opportunity to have the supports early on and experiences. And we believe that an early childhood initiative certainly positions young people ready to learn.
So you'd like to expand pre-K?
I would expand
universal?
It to a universal program where every youngster has to be part of a pre-K opportunity and really beginning to look at the research around three-year-olds. And, you know, I don't believe we can get them too early. And I would love to think in terms of what that would look like and how we could actually position a three-year-old initiative. You know, the world's changed from when I grew up. You know, my mother stayed home with me and we did numbers and we did colors and all those kinds of things. But right now, the way that I see many families, kind of two-income families just trying to make ends meet, and we want to be partners with those families and certainly and create a way in which those young folks can transition and make a great transition, and we want to support them as early as we can.
At the other end of the years, the Baltimore Sun's Erica Green reported over the weekend that a bigger percentage of Baltimore City school students, 46%, must take remedial courses when they get to college than any other school district in Maryland. How are you going to change that?
Well, I talked about the rigor, and we got to crank up the rigor. We got to crank up the experience in classrooms. We got to certainly, I think, do a more effective job in providing opportunities and access to really rigorous courses. One of our big initiatives is certainly around the whole issue of being college and career ready. And the way you do that is with classroom experiences, course experiences that allow our kids to be able to navigate tough work and to actually be able to navigate and move forward with respect to rigor and how that rigor plays out in standardized assessments that the colleges are looking to see as they move forward. One thing we're going to do very early on is really begin a strong relationship with our higher education partners to be certain that we're aligned and the expectations are certainly driving right straight into our classrooms. But when we begin to take a look at things such as our PSAT platform, we're looking at our SAT platform, we got to certainly get more children involved to have access to those types of opportunities.
And what role do you think the core curriculum standards are going to play?
I think it's going to ratchet everything up. You know, for a very long time, as we have been very decentralized in what we've taught, we've been, I believe the core curriculum will begin to centralize. You know, what we've said about the common, about the core curriculum is that for the very first time, we're not trying to cover the waterfront. We're trying to go really deep in with our thinking to give young people the skills that's necessary to be investigative reporters, to be great, great thinkers, to be constantly querying and asking the tough questions and deepening their understanding and then translating that understanding to the complexities of their world so they can navigate that complicated classroom experience. So I'm a big fan of the core. I believe what's good for the best is good for the rest, and really wanting to go very deep as our youngsters not only are able to go through an algorithm but understand what's behind the algorithm and the rationalization it takes to get there. Mathematics is going to become king. I mean, that's the champ. That's the champion. And what we're seeing now, the high correlations from kids being able to experience and navigate complicated mathematics formulas, complicated mathematical algorithms, I think is going to position them well as they begin to now move their way into higher education, whether it's higher education or to the world of work, that they can be positioned to hopefully kind of push back some of that the remediation that they've been having to take. We fail kids if we continue to educate them for 12 years and they have to take a remedial course in order to actually get into higher education or just the world of work to get a credential. So we need to drive heavily. A lot of our focus certainly is around the whole issue of high school reform. But high school reform doesn't just start at high school. You got to back that right straight in elementary school and then build upon prior knowledge and allowing that prior knowledge to drive where we are as an organization.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with the new Baltimore City Public Schools CEO, Gregory Thornton. Absenteeism has been an issue that the district has struggled with. What initiatives should we expect to see from you to keep kids in class?
Well, one of the big pieces for us is really trying to build strong partnerships with family and community. I believe education is everybody's business. It's just not Baltimore City's. It's all of us. It's from our clergy community to our elected community to our parents. And I believe when we begin to create a wraparound support for kids, we're going to see differences there. So we will open up conversation with ways in which we can support parents to get kids to school on a daily basis. Then I got to create a situation. We got to create a situation when they get there, something exciting to do where kids wake up in the morning and say, I can't wait to get there. So we got to make schools interesting. We got to make schools appealing. Yeah. See, I see my young people as my clients. And I got a client base that I got to meet their needs. So one way is certainly not only getting them there, but having something for them to come to that they wake up in the morning excited about being there.
Right. But I assume Baltimore City Public Schools have been trying to get
sure.
that excitement going and to have those bonds with parents.
Sure.
What strikes you as something that you can do that will make it more real?
Well, it's twofold. One, certainly to build on the things that have been done. Certainly beginning to have those types of conversation with parents. Certainly around creating the ways in which our classrooms become the place where the children perceive them as exciting and value added. I must believe that if children are happy about coming to school, they're excited about coming to school, they're going to come. I got to believe if parents are engaged in the process and help us with a sense of shared accountability around making certain that they're there, they're going to come. So we're certainly not going to do anything magical. We're going to do really good, hard work of getting to know parents a little better, getting and listening to children. You know, one of the things we're going to do very early on is a listening tour where I'm going to actually spend time talking with our young people at the high school level because that's where the challenge is. Our high school's aggregate attendance falls into the 80s. Our system is slipped a little bit last year. It actually fell back in the 80s. But our elementary school attendance, it's okay. It's not great. So one of the things when you have a concern, you got to involve the people who are directly affected by the challenge. And so the way you do that is you sit and you have conversations with them. So I think we've done a really great job, an okay job, and we're going to do a great job with working with parents. We're going to do a great job working with staff and trying to create exciting opportunities that folks want to be a part of. Now I got to listen to the young people and find out what's in the way and certainly work very hard and aggressively to create the schools that they want us to have.
The Baltimore Sun also reported yesterday that with less than 2 weeks before the school starts, city schools still needs to fill 211 teacher vacancies. High need areas, science, math, special education. What's causing this problem?
A couple of things. One, there are high need areas around the country, and we're all pulling for the same individuals to actually be in our classrooms. For us, one of the things that we will begin to look at more aggressively is that we won't move to our hiring season. And most organizations kind of get cranked up for hiring sometime in the late spring. we're going to have to be on a hiring campaign year-round. We will begin. We'll never stop. We will always be looking for talent and ways in which we can bring certainly talent to our city. I believe we have a lot to offer as a city. We have an exciting school district that's doing some very exciting things. The challenge that we face is that it was structurally going back to a conversation we had earlier where principals had a lot more control over the hiring. Well, in that, they had an opportunity to actually make changes and actually change the staffing configuration. And when you have that type of autonomy, which allows principals to do those things at the schoolhouse, it has impact centrally. And so it's always a point in time, meaning that on any given day, we had a system where principals could actually rethink, reprogram classrooms, meaning that if a principal felt that just due to the way the population trends were coming into the building, could certainly say instead of having two third grade classrooms, I'm going to have four classrooms, and you create two new positions if the money was in the budget. We're going to hopefully try to create a way in which we can have better communication to allow us to actually kind of lock down on a salary structure, on a teacher structure with respect to how those buildings will be staffed, and then structure to that, and then make a mid-course correction in September after the youngsters arrive. But we are confident that we won't be at 200, but won't be where I need to be. I mean, I certainly can suggest to you as I go into next year with our initiatives, both a strong recruitment, not only locally but nationally, and we're going to be better positioned. But we're always going to struggle for the math and science. That's kind of the thing that's driving the whole STEM initiative across America.
We have just a minute left, and I want to raise quickly with you. You arrive as Baltimore has secured $1.1 billion in school construction money from this state, a huge opportunity to shape physically how kids learn. How are you going to approach that?
Oh, enthusiastically. I think it's one of the greatest opportunities that's probably been presented to the city in a very, very long time. We see it. I see it as more than just new facilities. I see it as an opportunity for transformation in communities throughout our city. It's an opportunity to really reengage. It's a call to action for us to get parents involved in the educational process, and we're doing that. We're meeting in communities throughout our city and having conversation and really beginning to focus on the visions and hopes that parents have. We see it as a way to begin to drive curriculum in classrooms. We see it as a way to begin to even think in terms of a residual effect with respect to jobs. I mean, we see this as certainly our big, big renaissance opportunity here in the city.
And we hope you'll come back and talk to us about it again. Thank you so much for coming in.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much for having me.
Gregory Thornton, new CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us, everybody. In the 1973 movie Soylent Green, the earth is devoid of fruits, vegetables, and meat, and people are obliged to eat a powdered food made with plankton from the ocean. The movie takes place in 2022. That's just 8 years from now. But these days, much to the chagrin of chefs and foodies everywhere, a real product named Soylent is available for people who want to have a diet that meets their nutritional needs in as efficient a manner as possible. So this morning, a conversation with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, about whether or not a diet consisting only of Soylent is actually a viable alternative to eating real food. Monica joins me in the studio along with our intrepid senior producer, Matt Purdy. Last month, Matt tried the Soylent diet for a week. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Tom.
All right. So, Monica, tell us what this Soylent stuff is.
Well, the idea here is to basically make food an unnecessary thing in your life. You know, you have it just distilled down to the most essential components, nutritional components, and that's all you need to do. The guy that is behind this movement, you know, basically felt like he was spending too much of his time and his energy shopping and cooking and eating and cleaning up after it. And he didn't care that much about food. He wanted to get it done easier.
Yeah, so this is a guy named Robert Reinhardt, and
exactly.
he's a software engineer.
Right.
So
no background in nutrition.
He's not a food guy, right?
Clearly not a food guy because he didn't have time for food and he wanted to come up with something that could replace food. And they've been working on this for a while. And it's in the news right now because in May, they finally made a commercial product available. And it's been such a sensation that the product is actually backordered right now. If you want to buy it, you have to wait a couple of months to receive your shipment.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt Purdy, you wanted to give this a try for a week. Because it's backordered, I guess you had to make your own Soylent? You found the ingredients or something? How'd you do it?
Yeah. There's a whole sort of do-it-yourself scene online that you can find all sorts of different recipes that people put. And people keep blogs and they're sort of trying this out. They're living off of these different recipes. And so I found one called People Chow 3.0.1. And so the main ingredient is corn masa. So it's like kind of like a corn flour. Mm-hmm. And so I first got interested in this because I'm busy every day, as you know, Tom, and I need something quick and fast, but I want it to be nutritious. And so before, I would like run up to a fast food place or something like that, and it wouldn't actually be healthy, and it wasn't that quick. And so I was like, well, why don't I just like make something like this ahead of time in the morning and have it for lunch? And so that's where it started.
Mm-hmm. So you've mixed up a little batch of this stuff.
Yes.
So obviously the first question is, how does it taste? And Monica and I are about to find out because you've given us a little sample here. So tell us, you said it's corn masa, and what else is in it?
Right. So there's whey protein isolate. There's like a mixed powder of like vitamins and minerals. There's calcium magnesium powder, potassium citrate, iodized salt, choline bitartrate, and soybean oil.
So you buy all these ingredients.
Yep.
And then you make it like a smoothie.
Exactly. So you mix all the powder up, and then you add the oil and water, and you shake it up in a little bottle, and it mixes together, and then you drink it. You can put it in the fridge and drink it later.
All right, so 3 meals a day of this stuff. All right, so Monica, you go first.
Well, mine is already settled quite a bit.
You're the nutritionist. You've got to do this first.
Well, definitely get the vanilla. It's slightly sweet. It's pretty gritty from the masa.
Yeah.
If I were starving, I'd probably be happy to see this appear, but mm-hmm. short of that, I'm not
sure.
Well,
it's not too bad.
No.
It's not too bad. I was expecting it to be worse. I mean, it's kind of like a vanilla shake, I guess.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I have to say I've
sand in it.
I've sort of applied this on quite a few friends, and they all respond to it in a way that's somewhat similar. Like, it's not as bad as I thought it'd be. Now, I spent a week, Monday to Monday, living off this stuff, and that is completely different.
Because when we were talking about 3 meals a day and no other food, that's a whole other universe. But Monica, before we talk about that, is the fact that these nutrients are being – and this guy, Mr. Reinhardt, seemed to figure out what nutrients we need to sustain ourselves and put them all into these various powders. And you know, you drink this shake and you're getting all the nutrients you need. But is the fact that they're being delivered that way as opposed to being delivered, you know, through food that we would eat, a balanced diet of, you know, fruits and vegetables and legumes and proteins with meat and fish, et cetera?
Well, he's made some decisions for you here. He's decided which nutrients are truly essential. And it's not so much the way that they're being delivered, like in a liquid format. It's, for me, it's, well, what's not in here? So he's got vitamin C, but when I eat an orange, I'm getting more than just vitamin C. I'm getting quercetin and, you know, limonene and other phytonutrients that also come in that fruit. They're not in here. So I think that, you know, it's an interesting exercise. You know, maybe one day we'll all be on a spaceship traveling to another planet and we're going to need to be able to carry a viable food supply with us and a powder. And maybe that'll come in handy then. My question is, with actual food available, what possible advantage does this offer anybody?
Monica Reinagle, she is the nutrition diva. She's a licensed nutritionist from Baltimore, the author of several books. She does a podcast called Quick and Dirty Tips for Eating Well and Looking Fabulous. Matt Purdy is Maryland Morning's senior producer who tried the Soylent diet for a week last month on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. So, Matt, let's talk about psychologically what happens when you're supposed to be drinking a shake 3 times a day and that's your entire food intake. How's that work? That just seems so hard
right.
to me.
Will you? I think you begin to realize all the different things that food does for us, just on a sensory level. So I started on a Monday, like I said. I had that first shake in the morning, second at lunch. I was doing pretty good, and then dinner time rolled around. And I had to have another shake, the same exact taste, same consistency, everything. The next day when I got up and I had to have that shake again, it's just like I wanted something solid. I wanted something that tasted different. I remember I broke down and I had a carrot after work on Wednesday, and I crunched into this carrot, and it was a revelatory carrot. Mm-hmm. It was just like the crunch of and sort of chewing something was, it was like being in a sensory deprivation chamber for like a couple days and not seeing colors or tasting anything, and then everything just explodes when you actually, you know, have food again.
But it wasn't a matter of your being hungry.
No,
right? I mean this diet actually does provide nutrients and enough calories to sate your hunger between meals, right?
Yeah, you don't feel hungry. I mean, it's got 2,000 calories every day it's giving you, which is, I guess, the recommended caloric intake that I would need, but it doesn't deliver all those sort of intangible things that food does. And, you know, when you're, I mean, that's why I think it works on an emergency basis. Like, you need something quick and easy, and to have it on hand, it's very nice to have. But you can't sit down to dinner and drink Soylent, you know?
But as part of this experiment, Reinhardt and some of his colleagues actually lived on nothing but Soylent Green for 30 days at a time.
Soylent. We should go say it's not Soylent Green.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's Soylent Green's the movie. That's
Soylent
a really
Green
easy
is people.
Yes, yeah.
Yes,
right.
Sorry, I misspoke.
Soylent is the product we're talking about.
That's right. They did experiments where they went 30 days, 45 days, 60 days, nothing but this. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have made it to Wednesday, Matt.
Yeah, and I have to say, I was cocky. I thought I would make it the whole week. I said, I can do this. And Wednesday, I was just like, this is ridiculous. I have to have something else.
But you
so how many times did you end up cheating? I mean, let's just for the record.
Well, I made it.
I mean, we call it cheating in that you ate some solid food as opposed to just drinking this Soylent stuff.
So I made it to about from Monday until Thursday afternoon.
With a carrot thrown in.
With a carrot, and there was maybe a few, you know, some chocolate or something like that, some other stuff thrown in. But then I had on a Thursday night, I went and got pizza, and it was the best pizza I've had
ever. Right now, and of course, you know, it makes you very unavailable for power lunches. You know,
right.
I mean, it's just you can't do that. I mean, there's
or in my world, any socializing whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's how I spend my time.
Because food is, you know, much more than just caloric intake, as we, you know, learn quickly when we are just drinking it out of a shake.
Apparently, not for everyone. I have to say, it's for me, food is much more than just fuel. It's recreation. It's it's relaxation. It's how I spend time with my friends and family. But over the years, I have heard from people over and over again who say they don't care about food. It's not fun for them. They don't look forward to it. They resent the time and the money that they spend taking care of this biological need. And I've had people write in and say, couldn't we just make up some sort of people chow? That's exactly the phrase that they've used, so that I never have to think about this again. And this question always is very confusing to me, because that's not mm-hmm. how I approach things, but apparently there are some people who really don't care.
Yeah, because the inventor of Soylent talks about the advantages in terms of time. You replace all this time that you're shopping for food doing other more fun stuff. Of course, I love shopping for food. I love going to the farmer's market. I love going to the grocery store. But he also says that the cost is better. I mean, each serving a day's worth of serving costs about what?
So what the people who put together this people chow recipe said it costs about $3.50 a day. It took me about 5 minutes to make a day's worth of Soylent, sort of mixing all the powders together, adding the water, adding the oil, shaking it up. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes.
But for $3.50 a day,
yeah,
you can eat three meals.
Yeah, which raises.
You obviously can't shop for food at that price. So
yeah.
So the cost saving is significant.
Yeah.
And I would say that compared to the way a lot of people eat, this is probably more nutritious. It's probably, you know, got a better range of vitamins and minerals compared to what I would think of as an optimal diet with a real variety of fresh foods, whole foods, fruits and vegetables. I think it pulls up short.
And what about the sort of one-size-fits-all aspect of this? Does each individual human being need exactly the same nutrients every day?
Of course not. You know, I mean, the good news is they've made all the decisions for you. The bad news is they've made all the decisions for you, yeah. You know. And for people, for example, who exercise a lot or who are lifting weights, they may want more than 22.5% of their calories from protein. You know, some people want fewer than 50% of their calories from carbs, like people that may be dealing with blood sugar issues or diabetes. So it does sort of force you into a mold. Now, with the do-it-yourself community, you have a little bit more flexibility because I'm sure you can search for recipes that, you know, have some variance. So there's the inter-individual variation, but then there's also the intra-individual variation. Do you want to eat exactly the same thing day after day? And is that really a good idea? One of the fun things to think about, if you can get by the not eating part and the monotony of it, is what would you do with all those hours a day that you would free up? What would you do with the money that you would save? And that could be kind of a fun little thought experiment. Mm-hmm. You know, if you suddenly had...
Did you notice you were doing more or less or other different things with all your newfound time?
Maybe more time in the evening. And there is like a certain like I'm attracted to a certain like asceticism aspect of it. Like what's the most efficient way that I could possibly live? And there's a certain sort of adventure to that. But just for doing it for the long term, I just don't see it as something that I'd be able to do.
Well, I'm glad it was you and not me. I appreciate it because I'll tell you, I would last about an hour. All right. Well, thank you both. Good to see you. And thanks, Matt, for trying. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. You can check out her Nutrition Diva podcast when you catch the link at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And Matt Purdy is our intrepid senior producer. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, Mark Hyman stops by for a visit. We'll talk Orioles baseball and other things athletic. I hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of your public radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. When they're not eating, the show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers, and we have production help from Brandon Block, Alexander Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.